people, a few people are here, I guess you know, I'm Jim Knutson, and my main orientation has been Africa, missionary, together with my wife in Africa from 54 to 72, and secretary for Africa for the ALC and then the ELCA from 1973 to the end of last year. So my focus is Africa, but today I want to deal with a subject which comes out of my experience and my struggles as a missionary and as an area secretary and with ongoing concern in global mission and anything cross-cultural. And as you see, the title is Mutuality or Interdependence in Mission, Is It Possible? And I would like to mention a couple of books. One, Gifts and Strangers, which is for sale in the bookstore. And if you want a book that will stretch you, Anthony Gittens is a Roman Catholic anthropologist, missionary, mission professor at the Theological Union in Chicago, Catholic Theological Union. He's very well thought of. In fact, we use him to orient our missionaries. I think for the last three summers, he's been at the missionary orientation for the ELCA missionaries. He not only writes for people going overseas, but it's anything dealing with cross-cultural experiences. So anyone who's dealing with Indians, Hispanics, anyone from a different culture, this man will stretch you and will challenge you. He talks about the different worlds of meaning. He talks about the meaning of language. And one, probably the most important chapter for what we're talking about today, the meaning of gifts. And he has a chapter called Gifts, Guile, and the Gospel. And he talks about what gifts mean in different societies and the implications of gifts, the relationships that can be set up, good relationships, bad relationships. And then his last chapter is more to do with people themselves going into cross-cultural situations. But he repeats over and over again, I'm not only talking to people going overseas, but anyone going into cross-cultural thing. This is really a book that will stretch you and challenge you. And it's still, I read it once and I have to read it some more. And then a couple other books that are in the bookstore, to which I will refer. Some of you probably know The Gospel and Sol Tenamme by Ernesto Cardenal, and maybe you've used this. There are several volumes in the bookstore. Hearing the Gospel through the eyes of these Nicaraguans in dialogue with the priest. Fascinating stuff, and you get interpretations of Gospels that you've never heard of before, and it illustrates what I'm going to be talking about. And then there is also, and some of you probably have this, the peasants did the art, the Gospel and Art by the peasants of Sol Tenamme. Beautiful pictures, again, and illustrating in art the different parables. And I may be talking to everyone, to people who have these, but these are in the bookstore together with Gifts and Strangers. And then there are two others. If any of you are coming next week to some of my sessions on South Africa or on Africa, two books in the bookstore. One, The Church Struggle in South Africa by John DeGruchy, professor at the University of Cape Town, whose daughter happens to be here now, so it makes it kind of interesting. It has a different cover in the bookstore, so don't be fooled. It's on that table where there are books for sale. And then God in South Africa by Albert Nolan, a Dominican, Catholic again. Very, very profound, struggling himself with the struggle of the church in South Africa. And this too is, I would say, anyone in mission, wherever they are in the world, any place, whether it's in Minneapolis or Portland or wherever, this would be a helpful book. He breaks some new ground and he challenges you in a way that some books don't. So these two are for South Africa. They're in the bookstore, and this one is also there. Well, the title is kind of maybe a leading title, and I don't know if it's the right way to put it, but I'd like to start out what I'm going to say by a story, and I find the story now is being used in different places, so probably it's losing its originality, but I read it some years ago and I liked it. I remember using it at Wartburg once in a chapel talk. I remember that. You maybe don't, you don't have to, but there was a group of people in England, a missionary society, that decided they'd like to do something for a group of Africans in Sudan. And so they wrote a letter down and said, we would like to do something for you, church in Sudan. And the Sudanese wrote back and said, well, you know, they, and in fact, I think the English people actually said, we'd like to send you some bicycles. That's all it was. They actually said, we'd like to send bicycles. They didn't ask. And so the people in Sudan wrote back and said, we very much appreciate your generosity, but before we give a final answer, we would like to know, what can we do for you? And the people in England wrote back, nothing. And again, the people in Sudan wrote back and they said again, what can we do for you? And this happened three times. And when the third time, when the people in England wrote back and said, there's nothing you can do for us, wrote back and said, there's nothing that, you know, that you can do for us, we need nothing from you, the people in Sudan said, you can keep your bikes. That's probably, if I say that, that's probably in a nutshell what I'm trying to say. There's no quick and easy answer to this question. We just started down. There's no quick and easy answer, but there are three possible answers. There are people who would say, no, it's not really possible to have real interdependence, real mutuality, especially in today's world, when, as I will touch on as we go along, the fact that we're all aware of that we are from the rich, affluent North, and we are basically a Lutheran church, a middle-class church, or well off, and part of a powerful nation, and all those things. Some people say no. And I also remember a group of Cameroon seminary students saying the same thing. I was giving a short greeting to the seminary in Maiganga, Cameroon, a few years ago, and I gave them a nice little talk on this mutuality and interdependence, and we need you and you need us, and that's what we want to do, and that's the kind of relationship we want between the church in America and the church in Cameroon. And afterwards they raised their hands, some of them, and said, what you're talking about just isn't so. We need you, but you don't need us. There's really no real interdependence, really no partnership there. We need you. The feeling of dependence, very honest feeling. There are others, of course, who would quickly say, yes, there is a partnership. We have good partnership, we have good interdependence, we're receiving visitors, excuse me, we have a companion church or a companion synod, we have exchange programs, we have women coming here, women to woman to woman program, we have students from the seminary speak. So it's a two-way street. Well, to some extent they're correct, but maybe it's not quite that simple. Then the third answer I would say is, yes, it may be possible to have true interdependence or to work toward it, but only if, and that's the big if, and that's, I think, that's where most of us are struggling. If we weren't involved in the fact we are involved in global mission, we're involved in intercultural evangelism and struggling in our own cities or in our own communities, I think we're trying to say, yeah, it's possible, but we're not quite sure how it should be done. And DGM itself, the Division for Global Mission of our church, says we are committed to cooperating interdependently with churches around the world with which those churches are independent and interdependent. I remember, I would say about 30, 40 years ago, well, when I was at the seminary getting ready, not getting ready at first, but when I was finally felt called to serve overseas, this was not really an issue. The emphasis in those days was our going, our giving, our teaching. We were taught that we should be sensitive, and I remember dear old Dr. Burgess said you must read books on the culture of the Zulus and you must learn about those people, but not so much what that can do for you, but so that you can be more sensitive, so that you can do a better job for them, on their behalf, kind of for them. There wasn't much talk about what we would learn and receive. I might say that after about 3 days there, we learned that we're going to be receiving much more than we're giving, maybe 2 days, but you know, we didn't go out with that feeling. But at the same time, it wasn't one way even then, really, in the sense of what was happening. And just imagine for yourselves, and we're, I guess, most of us members of the ELCA here, maybe we all are, what our church would be like today. We have a lot of problems and we get frustrated with our church. What would we be like if we hadn't been involved with countries around the world in these last 100 years? Just think, if all we'd done is mission in America, if that's all we'd done, we had no connection with Japan, Papua New Guinea, Nigeria, South Africa, etc. Today we're linked with 42 different countries through personnel and another 20 through projects. Just think if all we had was that. So we have been receiving, we have been stretched, we've been challenged, we've received perspectives, we've received things all of us could tell from our own experience. But I'd say what the difference now is, I think we're becoming more conscious and we're struggling more with the concept of what we can receive and how we can receive and how there can be interdependence and mutuality. And we are obviously more conscious of belonging to a global church and a global community. And we're more conscious of the fact that we belong, as I alluded to in the beginning, to the rich North and the south, north-south economic imbalance, the militarization that goes on, our involvement in many places around the world militarily. And we're also more aware, because we're being told more, and I'll come back to a couple examples, of how the rest of the world perceives us, which I would say 30, 40 years ago, we didn't hear much. If they perceived us, they didn't tell us that we're rich and powerful, relying on military strength, we're arrogant, it's consumerism, emphasis on success. At the same time, we have racism here, we have poverty, we have all kinds of other problems. We're being told now more by others, and I'll give a couple examples of that, how we are also seen. We weren't much aware of that. We were kind of the shining light, the beacon on the hill, and we had it all, and we were the fair-haired people and all of that. So the basic question comes back, is it possible for us from this affluent, powerful nation to really have true mutuality and interdependence with persons and churches in Africa, Asia, Latin America, or here at home with other communities in our midst who are not rich, who are not powerful, who are of different color and maybe different language, different cultural background. So to move a little bit, and what I'm talking about today, obviously I should have started out maybe by prefacing, we're in a journey, we're all on a journey. We're all in this, and there's no ending until the end, and there's no easy answer, and I'm a fellow straggler or struggler with the rest of you, and we need to encourage one another. And what the few things I say here are not by any final answers or anything that I have superior knowledge. It's some things that have come to me as I've struggled with this, especially the last years, and tried to articulate a little bit more. And I've picked up things from other people, very helpful. And one thing is, starting in the beginning, if we're talking about how we can do this, there is a given in the beginning that we have a common task. And I'm indebted to Anza Lema from Tanzania, who's been the Associate General Secretary of the Lutheran World Federation in Tanzania, who said we have a common mission and we must start with the Lord. And the Lord is the common partner. And that's where we start. And we have that advantage as Christians. We're not talking about partnership in business or partnership between corporations, but we're talking about partnership with people in Cameroon or Japan or in other parts of the country, wherever it might be. We have that common commitment. And Pari Rushul Andraibi, Malagasy professor, right now guest professor at Lutheran Northwestern, togetherness means sharing a common cause and holding on to a common hope and participating in a common mission. It is the Lord's mission. So we start with that presupposition. We got a long ways to go from there, but that's a common ground on which we start. Now just a few things I'd like to throw out, and you can certainly come back to me with other things later, but let me just go through a partial list. There has to be mutual respect. And we in America, and we whites, need to constantly repent of our racism, our arrogance, and our prejudice. As one missionary said, if we really think we're really sensitive, we probably aren't. And if we think we aren't racist, then we probably are. Because there's some of that in all of us. And I can say that in this group. If there were different people in here, I couldn't say it. And you know what I'm talking about. Orlando Costas, the late Orlando Costas, missiologist, said we need a kenosis, an emptying. And there are a lot of things we need to empty ourselves of, and it's an ongoing thing, I guess like Luther said, daily repentance. And Lema again, we must regard each other as equal partners, equal in God's sight. In each individual there is a human dignity, and we should not deny this, but cherish it and nurture it. Of course, that's a Tanzanian concept, the dignity of the person, no matter who that person is, the poorest person out in the bush, the poorest person in the slums, that's a human person that has as much dignity and worth in God's sight as any of us. But sometimes we don't think that way, we look down. Another position, the Lutheran Church and the Evangelical Ethiopian Church, Mekanyesis, in a statement on partnership, and they were struggling with this, we were struggling with this together, and they say, We should have true and visible partnership on the basis of perfect spiritual equality. They admitted that in terms of finances, we're not equal. Let's face it, we aren't. In terms maybe of the education of the ELCA and the ECMY. We're not equal in terms of those kind, some of those things, but they said perfect spiritual equality. And we need to realize something we all know, but that in this business, to use an old saying, the ground is level at the foot of the cross, and we all are beggars, all of us, no matter who we are. We start with that. In fact, you could develop a whole line of thought here. I know Dwayne Olson at Lutheran Northwestern, and it's very valid that the only way in this is by the way of the cross, and it's the theology of the cross if you're going to have mutuality and interdependence. Someone else, a good friend of mine, has said it's like the camel going through the eye of the needle. And the only way, how can it be done? It's impossible. But if we think of ourselves as the camel, this person said the camel could be broken up and passed through the eye. Maybe we need to be broken. Well, you can play with that one, but it means there needs to be repentance and brokenness. So that's one thing, mutual respect. Then another thing, which is probably, it's very hard for us, we have to acknowledge our own vulnerability and our needs and our shortcomings. Admit that we are not self-sufficient, that we can't go it alone, and that's tough. We're all Americans here, and most of us Scandinavian background or German background, and you go it alone. That's how this country, that's how the West was won. I mean, there might be a couple people, but boy, you're on your own. And that's hard for us to accept. I know, I grew up thinking I really didn't need anybody else. I did, but I thought, I could go alone. And even when I started out early as a young missionary, I could go it alone. I mean, I found out pretty fast I couldn't, but that's how we're brought up. So we Americans, to admit to others that we have needs, that we're vulnerable, that we can't go it alone, and also that we don't have a corner on the gospel, we don't have a corner on God's gifts, we don't have a corner even on knowledge or intelligence, and that's hard because, of course, we do have a lot of knowledge in this country, a lot of technology, and I love one of the definitions that Africans have of white people. They say a white person is someone who knows a lot but doesn't understand anything. And there's a lot of truth in that. We have a lot of technical knowledge, tremendous amount. And we hit some of those countries with all that knowledge and we unpack our bags and we got it all. And they look at us and they go, those crazy people. They don't know, they don't have a clue to what's going on here. So we need to, then connected with acknowledging our needs, to also that we actually need things that other people have. We need their gifts, their insights, their perspectives, things that we don't have. How do we enter into this kind of relationship as individuals or as a church? Someone has said, what do we expect from the partnership? Maybe we don't expect anything. We enter into partnership with a church overseas or a church in our local community or a group in our local community. Do we expect anything from them, or do we expect we are only going to be the givers? And again, I think of Cameroon when they said there is no way, and I think of another experience in Cameroon where we sat with the church council, the National Church Council of Cameroon, and we were in the same kind of a discussion. Yeah, it's interdependence, mutuality, all these nice words, and they were shaking their heads. And, there's nothing that we have that you need, you in America. And we kept talking, and finally some of them came up. They'd never thought too much about this. And then one person said, well, we can pray for you. You need our prayers. Well, that was very important. Then another one, which I've never forgotten. The president of the church, who had visited in the States, said, and they were thinking, and then he said, I can think of something else. He said, I was in your country and traveled around he was here for several months, I think. And he said, I was amazed at the wealth of your parish education material. He said, And when you think of it, what we have, the choices that you have in a parish for what you want. Maybe you still can't find what you like, but I mean, it's just plethora of stuff. Out there, they're lucky if they have one thing for Sunday. A lot of places in Africa, Sunday school means that if there is a Sunday school, someone gets up and reads from the Bible. And if they're good teachers, they can, that's fine, great. You could say, couldn't do any better. But for some of them, it's just reading a story and maybe scolding the kids and telling them they should behave in church and they shouldn't make noise. There's no material. So he had seen all of that. But he said, on the other hand, he said, I think you're weak in evangelism. I see you're weak. So He said, maybe we can help you in evangelism. Well, we haven't had a Cameroonian evangelist over here yet, but we have had a Nigerian evangelist. Some of you know William Lautai. And the story from Wisconsin, where he was in this parish as an exchange pastor, and he perceived that they weren't doing anything in outreach. And it's quite a story, but he challenged them, and they couldn't do anything, and they were afraid to go out. And he started going. He said, and I know what he does in Nigeria. And he said to them, what's wrong? He said, are you afraid? Do you think they'll shoot you if you go knock on the doors? And he, by his own example and by his enabling, got this congregation into an evangelism program. Well, that's an example of the kind of thing that can happen. But I think one of the basic problems, too, in all of this that I've been touching on as I go along is that we look at these relationships, especially when it's a church that's from a poor country, and many of our relationships are, not all, Japan is an exception, but most of them, are from the part of the world where incomes are very low and where there's hunger and malnutrition. If not, they're just hanging on. We see the relationship on both sides in terms of commodities, of tangible items, of hardware, of finances, of technology, of equipment and know-how. And obviously right away we're on top because we've got it all and they don't. And also to add to that, we Americans are very generous people. We like to give. And often the first thing we do when we meet someone from overseas is, what can we do for you? What can we give you? And that comes out of a good heart. Like the Namibian women at the church-wide convention last year, I wasn't in that meeting that evening, but they said the first thing some people said to me, what can we do for you, without even hearing their story. Now, that happens over and over again, and these were well-meaning people. And here's where Gittins is superb, when he talks about the meaning of gifts and the fact that we have to learn what it means to give, and we have to learn what it means to receive. And he talks about that we not to receive is also wrong. And for us, it's easier to give than to receive. We have to learn to be gracious receivers. And it's not always easy. And then his last part of his sentence, we have to learn there's more to life and to authentic mutual relationships than our own intuitions or preferences. You know, just we have our mindset on what gifts mean. We don't realize what it can mean. Immediately the other person is in an inferior position. And I think of Bishop Shiri in Zimbabwe. 2 years ago now, we were there visiting Linda Tiedemann from our office in Chicago and myself. And we're talking about strengthening the relationship between ELCA and the Church of Zimbabwe. There's been a long-standing relationship, but not in terms of the traditional relationship in many churches. We've had some short-termers there, we've had some interns, we had good connections, but we would like to strengthen that. And immediately we start talking about this, and he said, before we even really got to it, I don't want a relationship based on money, because immediately you're on the top and we're on the bottom. But let's talk more about exchange of personnel, scholarships, so forth. And he was sitting there, and there were needs, and the Chesses lived in that country, in that church. There were needs, and I'm not saying he wouldn't eventually maybe ask for some things, but he said, let's start that way. Well, that was very interesting. And then the other side of that was, that day or the next day, we were sitting in the church office there talking to two pastors, and they said, we hear you had a talk with our bishop. And we said, yes, it was very, very well. What did you talk about? Well, I said, your bishop is a very wise man. We talked about strengthening the relationship, and he said it shouldn't be based on money, but should be based on other things, so that immediately we aren't on top and you're on the bottom. And they said, well, maybe that's true, but hopefully money will eventually come out of it, which is a very honest reaction too. You know, here are these rich Americans come. So we're fighting this. You know, it's hard. Immediately, that's the way it is. And I've been conscious all these years of, as mission secretary, of being seen as a come around with dollar signs all over me. And how I couldn't say that, you know. And it was kind of humbling, and maybe it was good that the last couple of years, in spite of how hard it was to be in that office and see the budgets cut every time you turn around, to have to go to some of these churches and say, we have nothing. And maybe it was good. The thing is, they couldn't believe it. And like the bishop, one of the bishops in South Africa, on this same trip, we had just come out of a very difficult meeting in Chicago. In fact, the next day we left, and we came from this meeting where our budgets had been cut, and we got to Zimbabwe and told the story. We got to South Africa. There are seven bishops. The first bishop we met, we told, he started out right away by asking, as they all do, we have a little session with the bishop, and they sit down with their staff, and they say, well, we know that all requests to the ELC have to go through the church-wide national council, but we want you to know what these are, so when they come through the council, you will recognize them. And we have this and this and this. These are our needs. And we said, sorry, Bishop, we can't help you with a thing. We might as well be honest with you. We just had our budgets cut again. There's no way we can help you. And also, we can't send any new missionaries. This is Cape Orange Diocese, and we've had several missionaries there. And he looked at us, and he said, I can't understand it. He said, you are telling me that, and he put it very politely, but he said, you are telling us that, and you come from the richest country in the world, and from a country where we go to learn stewardship. Well, there was no way we could, there wasn't much we could say. But it's probably healthy for us in the way that we, so that the power of gifts and manipulation that can be done through giving, that whole thing, Gittin's really, it's tough, but it's good, really stretching. And if this isn't in your library at the seminary, I hope you probably have it there now. Well, now, what can we learn in terms of things that aren't hardware? I mean, now, you people here could tell me things. I'll just list a few things that I have learned as I've traveled in Africa and worked with Africans, things that we can learn. We won't learn it all at once. But there are tremendous gifts, and I'll just quickly mention some. One is the whole concept of life, the life as a whole, that Africans can teach us a lot. There are no words in African languages, as far as I've ever been able to ascertain, for sacred and secular. And any African I've ever asked, I only know one African language, that's Zulu, but any African I've ever asked, they agree with me that in their language, in their original language, there are no words for sacred and secular. Because life is life, existence is existence, and everything is a wholeness. We are the ones with our Western thinking that have come up and divided life that way. A person is a whole, existence is a whole, everything is a whole. And to talk like the Africans do, I think you have to think in terms of a circle. There's no other way. You can't think in linear fashion like we do. That's very Western. And I've seen this over and over and over again. I even like to think of that in terms of the church's ministry, and that's getting off another tangent, but people start arguing what comes first, the word or the deed, you know, or proclamation and development and all this. It's, you draw a circle and you put all this pointing to the cross, and you get out of the dilemma, because it can all point to Jesus. Well, anyway, that's one. Another one is attitude, the spirituality, the attitude towards God. Now, I'm not romanticizing Africans in the sense that they're all perfect. It's just like if someone came to the States, they could go back and say, these are things I've learned from people in America, these are gifts. It doesn't mean everyone has all of them, but the spirituality. Last night we talked a little bit about communism, and the president, former president of church in Ethiopia, said there are no communists in Africa. He said, we believe in God. He said, no matter what else, and God is there, you know, the great creator. There's a spirituality and an openness. That's going to change, and it changes for some. Relationships. The relationships, and the saying that some of you have seen, which is classic, which illustrates this. You've seen it in different forms. Umuntu, ungumuntu, ungumuntu, ngabantu. That's Zulu or also Xhosa. It literally means a person is a person through other people or because of other people. I am because you are. My identity comes from being a part of the relationship in my home, my family, the extended family. We could even say the sub-tribe, whatever words you want to use. You know, what do we say in the West? I am because what?
I have.
I am what? What are some other things of I ams? I am, or I am therefore, or therefore I do this, therefore I am. Either way. I think, therefore I am. Whatever gives us identity. I have, I work, I have a degree. All these things that give us our identity. Not saying it's not important in Africa, but their basic identity. I cannot conceive myself as an individual. And the relationship thing is very, very important. And because of this, again, basically in Africa, and that is going to change, I suppose, as they get in the cities and everything, but they take time for people. And my classic story there is one that I heard about a Peace Corps young woman in state West Africa, I'm not sure what it was, who was going to meet her friend, African friend, at the crossroads by the market at a certain time. And obviously there are more and more people in Africa who do have watches. So they said, let's say it's 12 o'clock they're going to meet. And she waited for an hour and a half past 12 o'clock for her friend. Peace Corps girl stood there and looked down the road, down the path, and the African friend finally came an hour and a half late. And the American was a little bit irritated. She'd been in Africa a while, but not long enough to really get into African time. And this was African time. Why, you know, kind of why were you late? Because I met so many of my friends along the road. I had to visit with them. And the point is, it was more important for her to have a little time with her friends than to be on time. For the American, being on time was more important. Well, maybe we can learn something. Maybe we can't, but that's another thing, the whole relationship thing. And you see that when you see weddings, when you see funerals, when you see illnesses, the way they can surround you during a time of illness or a funeral. It's harder in the city, but they still do it pretty well in the city, even then. I mean, even though a lot of them are working, they'll sit, the whole groups of people sit overnight in the home. The body will often be in the home, and they'll sit there all night with them, just surround them. Well, some of that stuff, we can learn some of that. Hospitality. We can never be like them, but tremendous gift. And anyone who's been in Africa, you just overwhelmed. And one was going to church, and where is anyone singing? You know, and we can't make Africans out of Scandinavians or Germans, but we can learn something, and we are. It's fun that we're singing some African songs here, and some of them are finding their way into our hymnals, and there will be more. So I mean, we are getting gifts like that, music and worship, and maybe even a little bit of movement. We can learn something about their hope and their joy in the midst of oppression and poverty, the churches in Namibia, Ethiopia, South Africa, how they can celebrate. Again, we can't do it exactly, but maybe we can learn something. The place of prayer, I don't want to idealize, but I my experience in Africa has been they pray a lot more than we do. Maybe we just pray to ourselves, but a lot more prayer. Prayer before tea. Prayer before you go on a trip, prayer. Never have a church meeting without prayer. I think we can do that sometimes, or at least in our meetings, church-related meetings. So, well, these are just some of the things I just throw out. Now, there's another thing, too, that I alluded to before, and you're aware of this, which is another gift. It's a harder gift. That is the feedback that comes back challenging us. I alluded to it. But I have there's a passage from Dr. Perry, again, Rashulan Drybe, who wrote a paper on this from the standpoint of Malagasy, who... Lutheran, who 100 years ago the Lutherans came to Madagascar from America. So 100, they had to sell the centennial in 1988. And he says, "You came to enlighten us of the futility and backwardness of some things we were doing. We were, and are thankful to you for enlightening us, although we had to pay a very high price to give up some of those things." These are his words. We did come out of them into the light of Christ. Now, from our side, if we take interdependence seriously, we should also come to North American churches and enlighten them to see the immorality of their sex-obsessed society, the inhumanity of political, economic imperialism, the atrocity of the arms race, and the futility and self-centeredness of consumerism worship, and trusting in gold rather than in God. We really believe that we do partake in one holy church, and we should be ready to receive mutual critical reflection on each other's ethos. Now that's putting it right on the line. And that's the kind of thing, as you know, we have been hearing from others, and we get different perspectives of the gospel, different perspectives of ourselves. You read the story, the gospel stories in here, you hear them in here, the Magnificat and other things through the eyes of these peasants, and you read about Lazarus and other things, and it's very uncomfortable, because it's turning the thing upside down from what we have often done. So we need to hear these kind of things. There are other books, some of you are aware of them, Unexpected News, the Gospel Through Third World Eyes, and so forth. People that have been giving us this kind of feedback. In fact, a lot of the whole liberation theology, I feel, from Latin America and also from Africa, not as much written, but Boussac and Tutu to some extent, not so much liberation, but those people, that's coming back at us too and challenging us. And I'm sure some of you have read some of those. Maybe you all read some of those things. And often to them, voices and insights coming that have been tempered by living in the political oppression, like in Southern Africa or Ethiopia, and again the Gomezes and the Dumanis and the Tutus and the Farsanis and others, and challenging us: who is Christ for you? What does Jesus look like for you? Challenging us to contextualize in our own country. We talk about contextualization in other countries. What about contextualization in the midst of our secular society, which is kind of inoculated with Christianity and the lines are more blurred? So there are a lot of challenges that come out. And all the time we're reminded of the fact that, as you know so well, North Americans are 9% of the population of the world and we consume 68% of the resources. And then you wonder, can we ever do this? So, another thing kind of related to this that has been my experience as I have as served as mission secretary is the churches are challenging us to more on official basis. It isn't just some of these writers. And I remember in Tanzania sitting in a meeting. Once a year we would meet in Tanzania, all the partners from Europe and America sit around a big table with people from all the dioceses, 14 dioceses and 12 partners. And they would say, you know, we are taking care of all these things, but this is the request from the partners for some of the things we can't support locally. Help with our seminary, help with our radio studio, help with some of the other things. And then they would say, more and more it came out, we don't like this. This is hard for us. This is embarrassing, demeaning almost, but here we are again. And then more and more they would say, at this juncture, why are we doing this? Why do we have this thing? Because at this time in world history, you have material resources, you have the dollars, and we don't. And the way things are set up, you could say, well, it'll change everything, but you don't change it that fast. And then he came, and this is what I'm driving at. They would say, what are you doing to make people aware of the fact, even, of this imbalance between North and South, so that even that we're sitting here like this? Are you even talking about it? And we had some very articulate people in that church. It was good. You know, it's because in a way, I have always had ambivalent feelings too. Let's be honest with you. It always makes you feel good to be able to give something to somebody. There's no doubt about it. At the same time, I also felt embarrassed that every year we would come and we were the big daddies dishing out the money. So I was very ambivalent too. And we told them that we didn't enjoy this either. And yet here we were. But they said, what are you doing? And of course, Nyerere, as you remember, in spite of some of his weaknesses, he was one of the first Africans who articulated this whole thing and talked about the North-South and the need for better commodity prices and all of that, which is not much has happened. But at least they were talking about it. That's my point. And they went on to say the ELC Tanzania, was asked to, together with other churches, to comment on an ecumenical resource sharing paper. WCC put out a paper and asked all the churches to respond. And their response is very interesting, Tanzanians. This was a couple of years ago now. We need more commitment on the side of Christians in North America and Western Europe to bring to an end systemic evil embedded in evil structures which continue to breed poverty and misery. This commitment is better than great financial contributions. That's pretty interesting. We feel that our brothers and sisters, the Tanzanian church.
Who's that a quote from?
This is a quote from the Church Council of the Church of Tanzania. I think it was the whole council that adopted
the paper. Did it ever get reported in the Lutheran?
I don't think so. It should have. Well, this was about, it would have been good. Yeah. This,
it's not too late yet.
I imagine, I got a copy of this somewhere. This was sent in. There was the consultation took place in Spain. You remember that? Escorial, Spain, about 2 years ago in the fall?
Wow.
Yeah, and there were people who went from the States. They went from all over the world. So this is the Church Council of Tanzania. We feel that our brothers and sisters in the North have not fully shared our burdens and our suffering. We do not see many of them in the struggle against apartheid. Neither do we see full commitment in undermining activities of the multinationals. At most, we have the impression they feel that the root causes of our problems are located in the South. According to recent studies, the major root causes are in the North. Now, you can argue that and debate it, but this is how they see it, and there's a lot of truth in it. Well, that was very interesting. Another similar kind of voice in a way would come out of consultations and conferences in South Africa and Namibia. Where more in South Africa, because we've had a longer history, but also in Namibia, they'd say, we're grateful for your assistance, financial assistance, personnel, whatever you're doing, but what are you doing in your own country as voters, as congregations, as church bodies in relation to your government to put pressure on South Africa? That the Namibians would say, put pressure on South Africa, South Africa put pressure on our government to abandon apartheid and to get this thing changed, to start negotiating. This is before the negotiation. This is several years ago. And this you never heard 20 years ago. They just say, thank you, you know, or 30 years ago. But now they're saying, thank you, but, you know, this is only one side of it. Now go home and put pressure on your government to get this whole system changed. And so it added another circle, which is very valid, and which our people need to know that it isn't just enough to send gifts, but we also have to be concerned about the situation in which these people find themselves. So they would say, what are you doing about... And then another thing they're saying, too, is what are you doing about the problems in your own country? That's coming more and more. I've been quoting in my South Africa thing about from Villa Vicencio, saying you have no right to really be involved in our situation in South Africa unless you're struggling with racism in your own country and oppression in your own country. And it's interesting when people from South Africa come here, like in Chicago, and say, we've seen Soweto now after they've traveled through South Chicago. And Mandela coming and seeing what he saw. Tutu has just, maybe still is in Canada, visiting some Indian group up in Canada, you know. Fair enough, you know. They'll help us see.
And Mandela promises to come back.
Yes, he's going to come back too. Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, we've gone over there and said, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and we've got stuff here. As someone said, two nights ago, I think it was in one of my sessions, after the session, he said, we spent, and I don't know what he said, if he said an hour or more than that in their synod, I think it was Idaho, talking about South Africa. He said, we didn't talk about the Indians in Idaho and how, you know, and we agreed, all of us, it's both and, it's not either or. You don't take the pressure off South Africa, but what about the situation right where we are? So these kind of voices, like, that's what I'm trying to say, are coming back to us, and that's good. You don't get into this relationship and have it one way, and the relationship comes back to us as a mirror, as it's catalyst to us, and it's reminding us that we need to, if we have these partnerships globally, we also have to be concerned about local. And we just briefly at lunch even talked about that. I was thinking our congregation in Bloomington should be more linked up with some congregation in the Twin Cities. In fact, some people say you really can't have a meaningful partnership in another country anymore unless you have something local, whatever it is, so you understand a little bit of the situation. And it's easy to have one overseas, or easier to have some linkages overseas sometimes than close by. One other thing, and I'll stop, I've talked too long, but that is a part of this, and probably should have brought out sooner. One of the things that also we're being challenged by I'm talking now about the international scene, are you doing, and what can you do to facilitate more partnerships and exchange between us? So it isn't just Americans going to Cameroon or Cameroonians coming to America, or Americans going to South Africa, like the visits and students, but what about, can you facilitate more a Nigerian studying in Tanzania, or some Indians coming from India to some place in Africa where they could help learn and also teach? Or another new one now is Brazilians going to Mozambique, where they both speak Portuguese. And we're being challenged to this way, and it's slowly coming, and there are a few models. It's going slowly. But some people, for example, one person said to me, we have these exchange programs, and a synod now, we're going to have these companion synods, like we have the Church of Nigeria in the Twin Cities, and that's just starting. I mean, the Minneapolis Synod. And so we're going to spend a lot of money to send people to Nigeria. The St. Paul Synod has already sent a bunch of people to Tanzania, to their partner synod. That's fine. But someone said, how about if you sent, instead of 15 people, send 7 and give the rest of that money to, in negotiation with the church down there, and say, what kind of plans and dreams would you have about other exchanges south-south? And we will help fund it. Because again, let's be honest, the church in South Africa would never have the money to invite some people from Brazil, or the church in Mozambique, which is, by the way, the Lutheran church is very, very tiny. But we could have a partnership where they could design it and work on it. And some people have even said it would be great if those people could, well, maybe they shouldn't come at the same time. But the Americans would learn a lot if they watched Brazilians from the barrios interact with people from the slums in South Africa. But, and I heard about a case where up in some Indian area in Canada, there were Indians together with Americans, and I'm not sure where it was from. I heard about it from Karen Martin Schramm, secondhand. She'd been part of a group in, I think, Nicaragua, El Salvador. Indians from Canada and Americans. And immediately the Indians from Canada and the Nicaraguans bonded. And the Americans were standing around the outside looking, and they said they were frustrated and kind of disappointed, but it was an interest. And Karen said it was the most interesting thing she'd ever seen in terms of exchange of those trips. Well, that's another piece. So we need to, you know, and it's not easy because people, a lot of us, we had a discussion about this one day in the cities at this mission conference at Lutheran Northwestern, and this guy was saying, we need to see where our money goes. And I said, well, some people are saying, instead of sending 15 from the Twin Cities or from Minneapolis down to your sister synod, why not send half and then send the money? Oh, no, we've got to see where the money goes. He said, I'm talking for my congregation. He said, maybe I could do it. But he said, our people don't want to do that. They don't want to send money to enable someone from one African country to visit another African country. And they don't want to send money necessarily for an African to study in another country. If he studies, he must come here so he can be here and we can see him and he can come to our congregation. Now, this is understandable, but we've got to be more mature. I know I'm preaching probably to converted here, so, but we've got to be more mature. And that's what I said to him. I said, I know it's hard. See, there are people who give money for scholarship at Lutheran Northwestern. Fair, it's great. But then that person spends his Sundays or her Sundays at the congregation. That's okay. But to tell that congregation, now why don't you do another one and just have a scholarship and you can even get reports where you won't see the person, well, that's harder. But we have to be more true. So it's not only strengthening relationships and having more interdependence between ourselves, but also to enable more the South-South. Quote, I'll close with a quote from The Other Side magazine from an article called Partners in Transformation, How to Be Born Again in North America. And the whole article is very good, but at the end, she talks about this partnership and how difficult it is, and it's a difficult, vulnerable journey for us and our partners. The end is not in sight, nor will it ever be. As Christ assured Nicodemus, the wind blows where it wills. You hear the sound of it, but you do not know where it comes from or where it's going. So with everyone who's born of the Spirit. Okay, talk too long as usual, but had to finish the paper. We're in the struggle, we're on a pilgrimage, maybe is a better way to say it. And I'd like to get, we've got a few minutes for feedback. When is the evening meal tonight? I never can, 5. So if you want the first meal, which we need to if we're gonna see Solveig's slides, we've got a few minutes to. Karen.
It's not a question so much as some help from you or others here. The term third world, first world are not helpful to me. They just play in my chauvinism and my racism. Are there other terms that I could be using that are, or even developed and underdeveloped, doesn't
I don't
make
like
any
that.
Sense to me?
I don't know. I haven't found any that I like anymore. Two-thirds world I don't like? What do you think, Solveig?
I don't know. I was just going to say, Pastor Kmita always reacts so strongly against the one-third, two-thirds, whatever.
Yeah.
He said it was one world.
Yeah. I don't know. I say Africa, Asia, Latin America, and even that is, you know, then you got the Japanese. But there is no, third world certainly is not a good, and developing, that's.
That feeds into the idea that.
I think we just have to talk about the countries or.
Can't say north-south.
Well, that for some, like, and that's general too, but north-south, because I think that in terms of economic imbalance, but that's not precise, but it gives I think there generally the south is
funny. We always talk about how much we've learned from the Africans' holistic way of thinking of the whole and not divided up. I wonder if there's any African that's gone back to Africa and said, hey, I learned this neat new way in America. They divide everything up.
We should get into that.
Yeah.
Well, some of them had to learn. Some of them certainly learned that in seminaries in Africa, taught by good, honest Americans like us, and probably it's the conflict. They are still working out all of this. Obviously, they have to take in what they get in the seminaries to pass, and then.
You know how much
you taught some of those.
How much have we done this East-West? After Sobeys, the kids abandoned me in Harare, yeah. And I went to live near the Kentucky Hotel. I got to know this guy, Tony Nzinga, who had been head of the Council of Churches in Angola. And they brought, there were several Angolans there, and then they brought in some people from Mozambique to a conference. And I've never seen such excitement.
Yeah.
These people from Angola and these people from Mozambique chattering away in the bar of the Kentucky Hotel, which is kind of old at the Council of Churches, in Portuguese.
Yeah.
And he said, I've never had an experience like this. Just, you know, like that, they've been through the same, under the same Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that some of these things would be just, on the human level alone, so healing for them.
Yeah. I think one place we have to work on this, and I guess we're all ELCA here, is in these companion church. I'll back up. But we should explain to you that in the ELCA, we're working on a companion church relationship. So every one of our synods, if they wish, and they all seem to wish, will have a sister synod or diocese over in another country. Now this thing is fraught with danger and fraught with all kinds of the new imperialism. But I think this is one place where we can do this kind of talking. And
why don't
maybe
you make it a triangle?
Make it a triangle.
Yeah. Oh, we're not.
Make it a triangle.
Every relationship has to be a triangle.
That's actually, I've got a paper that our son wrote. We just finished, he was working on master's in missiology in Chicago. And he, in his paper, the one paper, he says it should be all three-way. And you shouldn't even start it until it's three-way. Well, some of them are starting two-way, but we should try to get them to be three-way. And
still
it would be exciting.
Such exotic kind of thing.
Yeah. It's really the companion church thing in the ELCA got took off faster than anybody had ever dared to dream. In fact, we hope to have a few pilot projects, and all of a sudden, for good reasons, it's taken off like wildfire. And now Mission 92, the idea that everybody's supposed to be linked up with somebody in another country, but it's fraught with all kinds of dangers, and we need to work very hard to not just have more imperialism in the new setup, where every synod now, they're going to do their thing. They're really going to help the poor Africans, because the mission office doesn't, the global mission doesn't have any more money, but we can do it, and then there'll be all kinds of this stuff again. So and Mark Thompson himself said he's I'm scared to death when I think of this. On the other hand, you can be excited when you think of the possibilities. So, Don?
Getting back to some of your earlier remarks, Cinda, I'm just always struggling with, and I'm trying to do some of this cross-cultural work in mission in the United States.
Yeah, sure.
I'm such a creature of my class, my social class, my economics. You know, no matter how much the gospel compels me, and you know, I preach it, and I want to do it. I carry this baggage of St. College on my back, and all my Scandinavian tradition, you know, and my music, and all of it's just, I've been so educated in this stuff, and I understand why Indian people from Canada relate more, they, you know, they're just in the same world together, and I'm in a different world, and it's just, the older I get, the more I feel impoverished by my education. Yeah. I mean, it's not that it isn't wonderful, but it's I'm not in the same social class as the people I'm trying to reach, nor are the members of my congregation. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're right in the middle of our neighborhood is increasing poverty.
Yeah.
And my only answer I found for myself is I have to use my gifts to try to encourage indigenous leadership to really take it away from me. I just have to give away the leadership of that church, you know, in some way, even if just one person gets raised up.
Yeah.
But I wish I was in an African church where maybe I was in a community, maybe you saw this, where the leadership emerges as of the same people. You know, that's why evangelism, I think, is happening in such a dramatic way. People are talking to their neighbors, their relatives, their social peers in a way that we don't do.
And even that started with people who came from another country in the beginning, who were different. You know, that's the God works in spite of us, in a way. And I know our son wrestles with that, and we did too. Yeah, you say it should be. When our son was placed in this big 500,000 re-seminary, he said, it should be an African. The church shouldn't put me in there. Well, they put him in there because they didn't have enough pastors. And he constantly said, and yet I said to him, you know, I said a lot of things, but, you know, trying to, as a father and area secretary, both your own kid. But I said, you know, Philip, you know, the church placed you, they have some confidence. And also, one other thing, and this sounds kind of crazy, but a good pastor, European white pastor, which you are, and sensitive, I know he is, and he grew up there, is better than just putting any old black pastor in there, you know. But that you can't say to everybody. It doesn't mean you're going to be a good pastor just because you are black, but I know how you feel, you know, and that's how he feels. He says, I'll never be black. I can't, and that's why he struggles with this stuff too, because I'll never be black. I'll never be one of them, no matter what I do. And I always have the back door to escape, even though he says he's going to die there. But if something really happens, his family can get the best medical attention in the world. And our missionaries know that. They can be flown out. They can be from Cameroon back to the States in one day. And then you say, why should we even be trying to do all this? And sometimes you think we shouldn't, and yet the answer is, as you say, trying to be enablers to let the Lord raise up local leadership and then keep pulling back. You know, that's the only way I can rationalize it. Otherwise, you can say we shouldn't be there at all. But it's something you struggle with all the time if you're in ministry, I think. There's no easy answer.
But the thing I'm struggling with is it really helpful at all to bring people over to this country to study in our educational system? If, I mean, you've done some of that at Warburg Seminary, everything, but you know, it seems to me that may be great for us, but it, in the long run, it has to be there. It has to develop in that culture. I mean, in the inner cities of this country, if we don't find a way to do theology in the inner cities, we're never going to train at Luther Northwestern Seminary or at Warburg the people that are going to meet our city challenge. I just don't see it happening. I mean, I've seen a lot of people pretend it's happening, but the only place I really see it happening is when I've seen Christians commit their lives, like your son, to say, I'll die in the inner city and I'll give myself to this community. That's where I see exciting things happen.
What's the reaction of the Warburg prof?
You said several things. My first reaction is the older I get in watching this, we load onto our overseas students just an awful lot. We hope that they will sort of open up our students and give our students perspective on our situation that we aren't always able to give them. And it doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it does, you know. Occasionally we get a student from overseas who has the confidence enough and his English is good enough to talk to our students in a way that will really make them somehow see perspective on where we are. That's sort of that's one side. I think the other side is that there are some, I don't think it almost happens because they're at the through the seminary, but I've noticed in this present generation of students an awful lot of people who are like the Holden types here and are trying to live a different kind of lifestyle. I mean, really they've put their lifestyle on the line, a lot of simple living, and these people are open in a way that I think maybe our generation wasn't, because we were just ignorant. To understanding that this is one world and that our, but on the one hand I'm a little pessimistic. On the other hand, I think we muddle through and we somehow move in that direction, and then also I'm not despairing about what happens at Warburg. I think that some good things happen almost by accident and by design. Now that's pretty general.
I think though you really have to question from an economic point of view, if nothing else, the wisdom. I know some of the millions that I have talked to are, on the one hand, grateful for the Lutheran program of Namibian students in the colleges here. But that program is terribly expensive. A lot of money goes into it. The students are, you know, get a trip back home after 2 years and then are brought back. And these folks that I was talking with said, you know, we could do 4 people.
Yeah.
Training them in Southern Africa.
Yeah. I have seen this from the other side, and I've struggled with the same thing. The positive side is that, first of all, I'd say I think it's better the farther along you are before you come over here. I think that's most problematic with BA or BS students. If you come over here, like some of the pastors have come over here with 10 years parish experience already, they've been around. When I sit around the table, and I told you about that Tanzania meeting, and I look around that table and realize that 3/4 of those bishops have studied at our seminaries, it makes me happy and it also makes me scared. You know, we have had a part in shaping them, even though they came over here as more mature men. Nigeria, you can go down the line through Africa, especially the bishops, the administrative secretaries, the heads of seminaries have been trained at our seminaries. Many times now more in master, or now we're getting the doctors. Like Nambala went back to Namibia, the first doctoral students from Lutheran Northwestern. I think it's better when you have that background first. But now to say it on the other way too, one of the reasons that some of these people are coming to get masters and doctorates is so they can go back and raise the level so that now you can get almost anywhere in Africa, you can get bachelor degree, except in Cameroon. So we don't get bachelor degree, or MDiv as we call it now. We don't get MDiv students anymore very much, and we used to get a lot. And now they're going to have pretty soon a couple of seminaries. Has Makamir got the Master of Theology now? They're working toward it. So soon there will be several seminaries in Africa with a Master of Theology. So they won't have to come over for that. They'll have to come for a doctorate, and that'll only be people who are going to go back to teach. And then hopefully there'll be more people that can study, because there are seminaries in Africa that are growing and developing, so they can do more of the study in their own. I'm thinking of theological students.